I've been in the Senate for over a quarter of a century, and the key is to get something passed that puts us on the right foot and we're able to deal with the problem that's happening.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
Well, that would be nice.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
Although in 25 years,
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair.
She hasn't gotten
and
anything
passed.
And
I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs.
Just saying.
Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Here I am.
Yes, I'm stuck in the middle.
From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the broadcast as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM. All across LA and environs. Also in California in Red Bluff and Redding on KFOI, Round Mountains KKRN, and in Eureka on KGOE. On the central coast of Oregon on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KSO, and Eugene, Oregon's KEPW. In Lancaster, Pennsylvania on WLRI, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU, Columbus, Ohio's WGRN. In Palinville, New York on WLPP. In Grand Rapids on WPRR, New Orleans, WHIV, Gallup, New Mexico's KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, in Seattle, Washington on KODX, we'll be talking about you, Seattle, Goldendale, Washington's KVGD, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR, and in Minneapolis, St. Paul on AM 950 KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day on the internets on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Indie Media Weekly, FYI Nation, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, GDPR, Revolution 99, Workforce Rising, Deprogrammed Radio, and Detour Talk, blanketing planet Earth 5 days a week. I am Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, all-around swell fellow. Says me from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today. Boy, oh boy, what a week it has been. But Desi Doyen, some good news for you.
Okay.
I'm sorry, I should say some news for you.
Well, there's so much of it. I'll just, I guess.
As of this weekend, we will be exactly 1 year from Super Tuesday 2020. Aren't you excited?
Oh, yeah.
Come on.
No,
well,
not so.
show some team spirit there, Des. That could be our way out of this mess.
Well, that is true. You make an excellent point.
Thank you. Also, the first in the nation Iowa caucuses and New Hampshire primary, they are now less than 1 year away. And
yikes.
What I know you're most excited about is the first presidential primary debates begin in June of this year.
Ow, way to ruin the summer.
3 months from now.
Oh,
cheer
man.
Up there. Man, are you a...
A Debbie Downer.
Debbie Downer, exactly. Anyway, those primary debates are going to be very crowded, and as of today, they are getting crowdeder. Washington Governor Jay Inslee announced on Friday morning that he will, in fact, seek the 2020 Democratic presidential nomination with a focus on combating climate change. So that should cheer you up, Des.
That does,
okay,
actually.
There you go. You're welcome. Along with a highlight on his aggressive critique of Donald Trump over the past couple of years, the 68-year-old governor is launching his bid in Seattle. Oh, hello, KODX 96.9 in Seattle. That following recent visits to the primary states of New Hampshire and the early caucus state of Nevada. Before his live public announcement on Friday, he released a video announcement of his plan to seek the nomination, highlighting, well, a montage showing him going from black hair to full white hair, right?
Yes.
Over the past 20 years or so, as he says, he's focused on climate change over those past 20 years.
Hi, Governor. What do you have to say about climate change?
A lot.
We have got to stop global warming.
Everyone in this country knows
climate is changing.
Reduce carbon pollution.
New energy future.
Climate change.
Climate change.
We should be dealing with climate change.
Climate change.
Climate change.
We need to defeat climate change.
That's what I believe.
We're the first generation to feel the sting of climate change, and we're the last that can do something about it. We went to the moon and created technologies that have changed the world. Our country's next mission must be to rise up to the most urgent challenge of our time, defeating climate change. This crisis isn't just a chart or graph anymore. The impacts are being felt everywhere. We have an opportunity to transform our economy, run on 100% clean energy that will bring millions of good-paying jobs to every community across America, create a more just future for everyone. I'm Jay Inslee, and I'm running for president because I'm the only candidate who will make defeating climate change our nation's number one priority. We can do this. Join our movement. This is our moment.
That was Jay Inslee, his announcement video today that he's getting into the race for president, Washington State governor. He is the first governor to join an already very crowded Democratic primary field, mostly dominated at this point by U.S. senators so far. There are some other governors thinking of getting in. Montana Governor Steve Bullock, two-term Democratic governor in Montana, a state where Donald Trump won by some 20 points. There's also former Colorado Governor John Hickenlooper. He's thinking about getting in. They would face, for a start, at least six prominent senators, including Cory Booker of New Jersey, Kirsten Gillibrand of New York, Kamala Harris of California, Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota, Bernie Sanders of Vermont, and Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts. Those are just the folks who are already running. Former Vice President Joe Biden may get in. Texas Congressman Beto O'Rourke are also expected to make announcements in the coming weeks. Inslee acknowledges his underdog status. However, in a recent interview with Associated Press, he says his emphasis on combating climate change will set him apart. Inslee told AP that climate change is a unifying issue, and he called it a moral necessity and an economic opportunity. Well, he is certainly correct on the moral necessity and economic opportunity part there, Des.
Oh, yes, definitely.
As far as unifying, however, well, the various elements of the recently released Green New Deal resolution proposed by Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Senator Ed Markey, those are, in fact, wildly popular. More than 80% across all political parties, according to recent polling, and most support the Green New Deal's elements, and most of the already declared Democratic candidates have endorsed it as well. But the resolution, the Green New Deal, calling for 100% carbon neutral power in the U.S. by 2030, along with millions of jobs to support that effort and the cleanup of legacy pollution and much more, that is not necessarily unifying among all the elected Democratic officials in Washington, D.C. In fact, you may have seen a video, most likely an edited one, of California's Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein recently speaking down to children that came to her office to ask for support on the Green New Deal, only to hear her tell them that she has her own version of a Green New Deal and that the AOC and Markey plans, unlike her own, couldn't get the support needed to pass, didn't have a way to pay for itself, and that unlike the children asking her to vote for the Green New Deal,
a non-binding resolution, by the way.
Correct. That she, not these children, knew what she was doing. We will talk a bit about her and the potentially emerging divide among Democrats over the Green New Deal with Emily Atkin of The New Republic. She'll join us shortly. She's been writing about exactly that and taking a bit of fire for it.
I'll say.
So we will put on our toxic flame retardant pajamas and head into that fray here a bit shortly. For Inslee's part, he promises substantial investment in clean energy sources to reduce American dependence on fossil fuels, and says that this issue is connected to virtually every other value system and thing that we want to do in our communities. Though he has not specifically endorsed the Green New Deal himself, instead, he advocates for a more piecemeal approach that he describes as ambitious but attainable, while avoiding a promise for specific reductions of carbon emissions under an absolute time frame. What do you think of that, Des? More piecemeal approach rather than this broad effort?
Well, I think the difference between what Inslee is proposing and what the Green New Deal says, the Green New Deal really is a framework for developing that legislation. And what Inslee has done is differentiate himself indeed from the other Democratic candidates in the field. But he's also proposing some specific policy legislations, and then those can be put through the ringer and examined to see whether they actually meet the speed and scope that scientists say is necessary.
That's what I'm concerned about, the speed and scope. I don't know if piecemeal cuts it anymore. But anyway,
it doesn't really, but it gets the conversation started.
We will get the conversation started with Emily Atkins momentarily and get her thoughts on Inslee as well. But first, we spent some time on our previous broadcast discussing how Republicans seem to actually have no actual defense for the president of the United States in response to his former lawyer and fixer Michael Cohen's remarkable testimony in the U.S. House Oversight Committee this past Wednesday, when he laid out details with hard evidence in support of several cases, at least five felony crimes, at least, that Trump appears to have committed. If Cohen is telling the truth, the GOP defense of the president since then, actually during the hearing and since then, has so far pretty much consisted of trying to tar Cohen as a liar. Oh, he's lying. Don't believe a word he says. Forget all of those felonies that he's documenting here. Now, he's already admitted to being a liar, to actually lying to Congress in his initial testimony that was on behalf of Trump himself. He told lies. He says that Trump wanted him to tell. That's part of what Cohen pleaded guilty to federal prosecutors, and that he will begin serving a 3-year sentence for starting, I think, in May. So call him a liar if you want, but he has documents and he has federal prosecutors who would not simply take his word for it anyway, as they pursue some of these allegations against Trump as made by Cohen. So the defense of the president regarding stuff like evidence that he defrauded banks and insurance companies, which Trump's campaign chair, Paul Manafort, is already in prison for, or that he participated in a campaign finance felony conspiracy by making hush money payments to Stormy Daniels and then covering up that payment essentially with checks written to Michael Cohen by Trump himself after he became president. Which, along with lying to Congress and some of the other stuff, Cohen is also himself going to jail for. So the defense to those allegations has been almost non-existent in the days since Cohen's stunning public testimony. But to be fair, there has been some emerging defenses beyond calling Cohen a liar. Over the past few hours, Lindsey Graham, who once called Trump a kook and completely unfit for office, has now become one of his top defenders for some reason. And today he claimed that those checks signed by Donald Trump in the White House since taking office for $35,000 apiece for about a year to Michael Cohen, said to have been to pay Michael Cohen back for the $130,000 personal home loan that he took out in order to pay that hush money to a porn star just before the election to keep her quiet about the tryst that she had with Trump. Graham says that that is was actually not, I guess, to pay Cohen back to cover up a crime, a campaign finance crime. Here's Graham today.
The Stormy Daniels payments and the check that Michael Cohen brought yesterday to the committee hearing. Do you have any concerns that the sitting president committed a crime and a campaign finance violation?
Well, number one, I think the campaign finance law is that the only reason you would do this would be to avoid, to help your campaign. If there's another reason, like protecting your family or your wife, I mean, I think Trump has done this in the past, but I found that most people don't write checks if they think they're involved in a crime. You know, here's my part of the crime. So good luck with that one. We'll see what the Southern District of New York does, but generally speaking, people don't write checks if they think they're committing a crime.
Is he really arguing that ignorance of the law is an excuse?
I'm not sure what he's arguing, to be frank. No, he seems to be arguing that if this was a crime, if he was trying to cover up this illegal campaign finance payoffs right before the election, that he wouldn't have included a check, a paper trail along with it. Somehow, I guess he would have just handed Michael Cohen $35,000 a month in satchels.
Because he's a great, nice guy?
No, that he would have, if it was a crime, he would have given him $35,000 a month in satchels of cash, basically, rather than writing a check for it. So he wrote a check for it. Therefore, it's probably not a crime. The claim is, of course, it was just a legal retainer. It was for legal services, not to pay Michael Cohen back for $130,000 that he took out in a home loan from his own money, which is all very well documented. So that seems to be the only real defense of the president of note that I have seen over the past few days, other than Michael Cohen is a liar. So yeah, good luck with that, Senator. And then there's Donald Trump sort of defending himself here. I usually don't like to read his insane tweets to you, but in the spirit of fairness, just to give you some idea of what the defense seems to be for his behavior, he unleashed a series of unhinged tweets, as he always does, but particularly he tweeted, "Wow, just revealed that Michael Cohen wrote a, quote, love letter to Trump manuscript for a new book that he was pushing, written and submitted long after Charlottesville and Helsinki, his phony reasons for going rogue. Book is exact opposite of his fake testimony, which now is a lie." So he's gone from fake news to calling it a fake hearing. Now it's fake testimony. The reference to Charlottesville, where a race riot ended in a white supremacist murdering a protester, after which Trump said there were very fine people on both sides. And to Helsinki, where Trump seemed to roll over to Russian President Vladimir Putin. Michael Cohen had cited those as reasons that he had begun to, I guess, lose faith in Donald Trump as a, well, as a human being. Trump went on to say, "Congress must demand the transcript of Michael Cohen's new book given to publishers a short time ago. Your heads will spin when you see the lies, misrepresentations, and contradictions against his Thursday testimony." It was actually Wednesday, but he was out of the country, so he's time zones. Anyway, he says, "Like a different person, he is totally discredited." He continued then, "Oh, I see. Now that the 2-year Russian collusion case has fallen apart, there was no collusion except by crooked Hillary and the Democrats. They say, gee, I have an idea. Let's look at Trump's finances and every deal he has ever done. Let's follow discredited Michael Cohen and the fraudulent, dishonest statements he made on Wednesday. No way. It's time to stop this corrupt and illegally brought witch hunt. Time to start looking at the other side where real crimes were committed. Republicans have been abused long enough. Must end now." Yes, it is unhinged. Sorry to read it to you, but you need to know how unhinged your president now is. So there you go. In the interest of fairness, this seems to be the defense against Cohn's testimony at this time, where Cohn had cited at least 5 different felony crimes by Donald Trump, both before and after he took office. All right. We'll have some closing thoughts on the Cohen testimony at the end of the program, but let's take a quick break. And it's not just Republicans who are having problems here. Democrats are sort of turning on themselves as well. We'll talk about that with Emily Atkin right after this on the broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Don't go away. Yes, welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. You may have seen a version of a video that went viral over the past week or so showing 85-year-old Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein of California meeting with a couple of dozen kids from the Sunrise Movement in her office out here in San Francisco. The Sunrise Movement has been one of the loudest and longest, really, citizen groups, advocate voices calling for a Green New Deal along the lines of the one recently introduced by freshman Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez of New York and veteran Senator Ed Markey of Massachusetts. Their resolution is a blueprint for a 10-year wartime-like mobilization to transition the U.S. economy and power grid to 100% carbon neutral by 2030, with a massive investment in infrastructure and jobs to support it, along with a focus on helping vulnerable communities and workers such as coal miners survive and indeed thrive in that transition while cleaning up decades of legacy pollution. Now, the meeting with the Sunrise Movement children in Feinstein's office did not go particularly well for Feinstein, who said that she has her own version of a Green New Deal that the kids there wanted her to agree to vote for. But she said she's got her own version of a Green New Deal, and I'm sorry to say she seemed to talk down to the children. Now, to be fair, the video that went viral that most of you may have seen, if you did see this over the past week, that video was somewhat unfairly edited, I think, by the Sunrise Movement folks. I don't believe that they did it on purpose, but the 10-minute or so meeting looked much worse in that 2-minute clip than it was in actuality, I think, at least upon my own review of the full video. In the full video, Feinstein looked better, but frankly, still not great. Here's the first unedited few minutes of that encounter between Senator Dianne Feinstein and the, frankly, very smart kids of many different ages from the Sunrise Movement.
Hi.
Hi.
Hello.
Oh, tell me where you're from.
We're from all over the Bay.
All over the Bay.
Yeah.
Okay.
All, over the Bay.
All right. And tell me what you're doing here.
We are trying to ask you to vote yes on the Green New Deal.
Please.
Okay. I'll tell you what. We have our own Green New Deal piece of legislation. Why don't you call back, see if they can fax one out, make a copy for each person.
Well, we're trying we're trying to promote the Green New Deal.
Well, there are reasons why I can't, because there's no way to pay for it.
Yes, there is.
That's we have tons of money going to military. Half of our, a lot of ours is going to military.
Well, I understand that. The United States government does a lot of things with the money, and they're important things. And you just can't go in and say, okay, we're going to take hundreds of millions from here and hundreds of millions from there. It just doesn't work that way.
But of course our
But you can have, I don't agree with what that resolution says. That's part of it. And we have done our, can you get a copy of the resolution?
Yeah,
Senator, we need a
coming.
Plan that.
And let me just finish. I will give you a copy of what we do support. And you can take a look at it. And if you've got a problem with it, you can let me know. But I think it has a much better chance of passing than what this is, because there is no way to pay for what it gets done, so nothing will happen. So you be the judge. You take a look at it. We're going
to
get you a copy.
But we have come to a point where our Earth is dying, literally, and it is going to be a pricey and ambitious plan that is needed to deal with the magnitude of that issue. And so we're here asking you to vote yes on the resolution for the Green New Deal, because that is the only thing
that resolution will not pass the Senate. And you can take that back to whoever sent you here.
Why do you
tell
them?
Because it doesn't have a single Republican vote. And the Republicans control the United States Senate. So we are a minority on the Democratic side. So the key to good legislation is to tailor something that you write so that it can pass and you can get a step ahead. I've been doing this. I've been in the Senate for over a quarter of a century, and I know what can pass and I know what can't pass. And the key is to get something passed that puts us on the right foot and we're able to deal with the problem that's happening, instead of something that won't get passed.
Well, why does that stop you from voting yes? Because even if they vote, you can still vote yes and it won't pass and we can draft a new plan.
Well, I may do that. We'll see. Yeah.
So that was the first few minutes of Dianne Feinstein's meeting with a bunch of kids from the Sunrise Movement about a week or so ago. And it gives you just some idea of what's going on the Democratic side of the climate change battle, while on the Republican denialist side. On Sunday, the Washington Post reported that the Trump administration is assembling a panel of fringe industry-funded scientists who represent the Trump administration's most forceful effort to date to challenge the scientific consensus that greenhouse gas emissions are helping drive global warming and that the world could face dire consequences unless countries curb their carbon output over the next few decades. But as environmental reporter Emily Atkin at the New Republic observes this past week, following the viral release of that Feinstein encounter with terrified children, as Trump denies climate change, Democrats delay. Feinstein, writes Atkin, is not a climate villain on par with Donald Trump. She has a 90% lifetime rating from the League of Conservation Voters, while Trump is withdrawing the U.S. from the Paris Agreement and his EPA is methodically attempting to undo everything it accomplished under President Barack Obama. But, Emily writes, the California senator, and here's where we get to the controversial part from Emily, the California senator is the bigger threat to the left's goal of slowing climate change before it's too late. That in a headline, in an article headlined, Dianne Feinstein is a bigger climate threat than Trump over at the New Republic. Well, that charge may have raised a few eyebrows and angered a few Dems in the social media world over this past week. Here to splain herself is Emily Atkin, the environmental reporter from the New Republic. Emily, welcome back to the broadcast.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Oh, you're in such trouble. Before we get to the Feinstein matter, however, and hopefully Democratic House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and her own comments about the Green New Deal, which you argue in a separate article may have been misinterpreted somewhat by some, Democratic Washington State Governor Jay Inslee jumped into the 2020 nomination race on Friday with his intention of seeking the nomination based on a focus on taking on climate change. I wanted to get your quick thoughts on that. And yes, I guess none of the other candidates currently running have yet to make climate their top priority. So maybe that is an in here for Jay Inslee, even as he's not particularly well known across the country yet.
I mean, as a human being and a character, I don't really see Jay Inslee as a very exciting nominee for the Democratic Party. And I think that for any climate policy to get through and for Democrats to really win, they need an exciting nominee. And Bernie Sanders does have a full climate plan just from, you know, from when he was running last year. So he's a bit ahead on that. But yeah, nobody else is running on climate change. I don't see how he's going to be really an exciting, mobilizing figure. He's an old white dude, and he's not even as weird or quirky as Bernie Sanders, right?
So, also an old white dude, yes.
But I do think is that it is great to have somebody running on climate change who is going to push the rest of the field to be knowledgeable about this. Because really, in every other presidential cycle, Democratic nominees or candidates to be the nominee have never really been pushed on specific questions about climate change. They don't even get climate change questions during debates. So to really have somebody who's knowledgeable about what we need to do to really make a dent in this huge problem that we literally don't have that much time to solve, I think it's going to really help move the conversation forward and help drive the urgency. So I'm excited about what he's doing. I think that him as figures, maybe. I mean, who knows? Maybe he's going to be great.
Well, but no, I agree. I think it's good to have someone pushing this issue because you also have a lot of these candidates, I should say, who have already signed on board for the Green New Deal. But to have someone who's raison d'etre, if you will, is actually trying to push climate change, no matter what Inslee's record may have been. And I've heard from folks saying his record in Washington State is not that fantastic. But I agree that I think having him in here, if only to push everyone else, is a good idea. Now, he mentioned, Emily, in his in an interview with AP, that he believes, quote, climate change is a unifying issue. He described it as a moral necessity and an economic opportunity, which clearly it is, at least for everyone but the fossil fuel industrialists anyway. But as I noted in our previous segment, the elements of the recently released Green New Deal polls very, very well. Like 80% among Americans of all parties, they do. It is a unifying issue, it seems, among the public. But among elected Democrats on Capitol Hill, there is a divide, as we see in that video with Dianne Feinstein. Even if most of the currently declared presidential candidates have said that they support the Green New Deal, there does seem to be a split, at least through part of the party. So how is your article, which argues that Dianne Feinstein is a bigger climate threat than Trump, how do you explain that? How is she a bigger threat to the climate than Donald Trump?
Yeah, what I mean is that she is a bigger threat to our one opportunity that we have to make a dent in climate change and make a significant dent. I think that people don't grasp that when the IPCC, the international body of scientists at the UN, says that we have 12 years to get this stuff accomplished, that's not a very long time. And we have two parties in charge right now. This is the reality of our system. One of them is not going to do anything, and we can never depend on them to do anything to try and solve this problem. And that's fully what I believe, and I think any realist believes that. Our only hope to get this done is through the Democrats. And Dianne Feinstein has a preoccupation at this moment with what's passable with Republicans in charge, and she's focusing on this in a moment when they're not going to pass anything either way because Republicans are in charge. Right now is the time to mobilize on the idea of the most aggressive, most exciting climate plan possible and use that to take control of the House and the Senate and the presidency in 2020, and then get some, and then you talk about what is passable, because nothing is going to be passable right now. And also the Democrats are not going to take power in 2020 unless they run on really bold, exciting messages. I think that we've seen that pragmatism, it's just a bad strategy for winning elections, just running on saying, well, we're not going to be as bad as Donald Trump. I think we saw in the midterms that that doesn't work. I think that young people understand that we only have a few years left to implement bold solutions necessary. And right now you have some of the most powerful Democrats speaking actively against bold solutions, not even willing to vote for a resolution that doesn't even, I mean, sorry, it doesn't even mean anything. You know, if Dianne Feinstein supported this resolution, does it mean that she's voting for the legislation? Really, she's just kind of crapping on the only plan that's been put forward that has the emissions reduction goals and the realistic, the plan that could meet them, necessary, that scientists say could actually do something. The plan that she put forward is, it wouldn't do anything.
Yeah, did you, she kept referring to that several times in that video, to her own Green New Deal plan, though frankly I couldn't tell from that video if she even knew what was in it. She said, well, we got a different plan, it's way better. Her plan is, at least the draft that I saw, is about 4 pages long. I presume you had time to look at it. How does her plan differ, her Green New Deal differ from AOC's Green New Deal as you see it?
As I see it, as I read it, the climate change resolution put forward by Dianne Feinstein is mostly a reinstatement of the status quo during the Obama administration. So putting back all of the regulations for the climate that Trump is attempting and has repealed. getting back into the Paris Climate Agreement, putting forth, you know, another big money mobilization and new technologies mm-hmm. and things like that. It doesn't call for any of the big social reforms that Ocasio-Cortez's Green New Deal resolution calls for. The idea of the Green New Deal, social policies like universal health care, free education, et cetera, is that you have to take some of these market-based mechanisms out of society so that we're not overproducing anymore. You know, like we're only producing as much as we need because it's in government control. Mm. And then it also doesn't include the big economic stimulus package that the Green New Deal is. You know, the Green New Deal is supposed to provide a federal job guarantee and, you know, government-led funding of new renewable energy jobs and technologies and then, you know, employing people in it. It's the New Deal, but green. And it doesn't have that big transformation, the big societal transformation within it. It's sort of just a larger, like, status quo plus 10%.
But Feinstein's argument was that there's no way to pay for it in the Ocasio-Cortez plan, whereas she, A, knows how to pay for it, and B, can get Republicans on board. I guess the mechanism for payment in her plan is basically a carbon tax? Is that how you read it? That's all I saw in
there.
I
don't know how she proposes we pay for climate. The amount of climate change that's going to happen under her plan is what we can't pay for. Mm-hmm. I think people don't understand when they talk about cost in terms of a plan, is that doing something costs less than not doing something. We have the ability to borrow money from the future, and so I don't see how we can't pay for anything. But that's
And the other argument that she was offering there is that the AOC plan would that it has no Republican support, and that plan can't possibly get Republican support, which may or may not be true. As I said, since it's wildly popular across all demographics, getting more than 80% approval. But we spoke with David Roberts a couple weeks ago on the show on the day that the resolution was first released. He argues, as you do, Emily, that Republican officials at this point are not going to come on board with anything that Democrats produce that actually deals with the climate crisis. So why not just go for it, and as AOC and Markey do here? But if that's the case, if Republicans won't come on board and the idea is to just go for it as aggressively as possible, they're still, for the time being anyway, Republicans are needed in the Senate to pass anything. And then we've got an insane climate denier clown in the White House. So really, what is the path forward here, Emily?
I mean, I think I laid it out sort of a bit earlier. The path forward is to support something exciting. Demonstrate that you know, as a Democrat, what it means when you say climate change is the biggest crisis of our time, which is what Dianne Feinstein says, but doesn't demonstrate it with the type of plan that she put forward. Yes, potentially it's more achievable mm-hmm. right now, but it's not. Nothing is going to be achievable until 2020. I don't think that. I think that as long as Trump is in the White House, nothing of this scale is achievable. So it does. I think the path forward right now is to demonstrate to voters that you truly understand the magnitude of this crisis, that you're willing to support societal change to get there, excite people, make them hopeful for the future, instead of saying, you know, like, well, we're going to support this lukewarm thing that's not going to do anything, and then people are just drawn back into apathy, you know. And once we have people in power who are willing to do this, then we talk about like how we're going to craft this legislation to get the votes to pass it. I wish, you know, for my potential future children's sake that we had something aggressive that we could pass right now, because I've been covering climate change for 5 years, and you know I know that the stakes are really high, and they're a lot higher than Dianne Feinstein makes it out to be when she's talking to these kids. And you know, I wish that they could pass something now, but I don't personally, like, I don't think that what they would pass now would do anything.
So even like, if, really even if you compromise, even if you compromise to get those Republican votes, what you end up with is not enough to meet the moment, essentially. I should also...
Right, because this is a global problem, right?
Yeah.
So even the hugest thing we do
is
still a fight.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. Even if we do everything in this country, we still have to deal with the rest of the world. Although, I should say, the Green New Deal does talk about working with, you know, other countries to sort of spread the, as Nancy Pelosi sort of smeared it, the green dream across the globe. Which brings me to this other point here. We've got just a minute or two left, Emily. Pelosi has taken some flack for her less than full-throated support for the Green New Deal. As I said, she somewhat dismissively called it the Green Dream. But you argue in another article at The New Republic this week that Pelosi's take on climate action may have been somewhat misinterpreted, at least as far as what you read into her recent interview with Rolling Stone?
Yeah, I don't think that Nancy Pelosi fully supports the Green New Deal or gets the Green New Deal. I feel that she, from her comments, that, you know, she is dismissive of it. However, I do think that, as Dave Roberts said in one of his pieces, who you talked to last week, when she does this, engages with AOC in this way, it builds more tension and more attention towards the Green New Deal, and the public is starting to pay attention. Dave Roberts thinks that that's intentional. I'm not sure about that, but what I paid attention to most in her Rolling Stone interview was how often she said, this needs public support for it to go through. You know, she basically kept saying, I can't do this on my own. She said, I used to be an activist. Mm-hmm. I was carrying single payer signs before you all were born. And if I were still an activist, I'd probably be sitting outside of my own office with these signs right now. But I'm not. I'm a leader in Congress. And my job is to get things through that are passable. And in order for this to be passable, we need more public support for it. She's basically doing what FDR may or may not have said.
Right.
You know, I like it. I want to do it. Now make me do it.
Right, exactly, which Obama used to cite all the time, basically saying, force me to do it. And Pelosi did tell Rolling Stone, I understand that to be an advocate, you are persistent, dissatisfied, and relentless. I've been there. I understand it. You have that responsibility as an advocate. She did seem to be saying, force me to do it, essentially. But, you know, I'm also, you know, the fact is that the Green New Deal, the Green Dream, is wildly popular, at least right now, among the public. So the problem doesn't seem to be the public. It seems to be the elected officials. And I'm not sure how much noise and protesting and support is actually going to change some of those folks. Emily, I've got...
I disagree.
You disagree?
I disagree. I was just going to add that I think that it's about priority. A lot of people support things, but a lot of people don't prioritize them. We've had most people in this country believe climate change is real for years and years and years now, but they don't prioritize it. And so, 80% of people might support the Green New Deal, but do 80% of people prioritize it? Are they going to vote on it? No, and that's what protesting and mobilization will do.
Mm. Many Democrats seem, and I'm talking about voters at this point, sort of seem dead set on eating their own. And I hope that activists continue to push this, obviously, as the very real emergency that I believe that it is. And that they should push it, as we discussed, you know, Inslee, making this a defining issue for Democrats. I was very happy to see Feinstein, by the way, challenged by a more progressive Democrat in her 2018 election. I'm fine with that. My concern or it's not even because it's a question, Emily. Does action on climate risk becoming another issue like the ones that we saw divide the party in 2016? Because I'm not sure that we, meaning the country and the world, not the party, but that we can survive another such divide in 2020. I'm wondering if Democrats are capable of, you know, pushing forcefully and unapologetically without sort of turning on each other with the, you know, burn it all down, destroy your enemies sort of toxic tactics that they seem to have adopted from, you know, the Karl Rove, George W. Bush years, which is now metastasized to both Republicans and Democrats alike. Do Democrats have the ability to make this the fight that it needs to be without eating themselves alive?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not worried about the Democratic Party's survival. I'm worried about the planet's survival mm-hmm. for future generations. I don't think it's as big of a deal if the party can survive. And honestly, this debate is that's happening right now. This you characterize it as eating their own. I characterize it as the most productive debate on climate policy I've seen in 5 years of doing this. It is really the first time I've seen constructive arguments over it. That it's the first time I've covered a policy climate debate that isn't stupid, to be honest. and it's the first time that I feel like people are starting to understand the stakes here. And so if it seems like the Democrats are eating each other alive over this, the Democrats are the only ones engaging on the biggest issue of our time. And I think that that's, you know, it's too late. It's a little too late, but, you know,
well,
I guess it's not too late. Do you know what I'm saying?
I do.
I'm just not concerned about it.
Good. Well, I do, but of course, I'm not the one who wrote the article headlined, Dianne Feinstein is a bigger climate threat than Donald Trump. So
I didn't write that headline.
I know you didn't. I know. I won't hold it against you too much. And
I
agree.
I did write everything else in the piece.
I know, and I agree. And by the way, I don't think, or at least I hope, that Democrats don't eat themselves alive over this, even while they push it in a way they have never pushed it before. I just hope it doesn't get to that point. But we'll see. And we'll call you back to talk about it when it happens, Emily. Emily Atkin, you can find her work at newrepublic.com. And you should follow her on the Twitters, where she is, it's hard to spell, M or we. That's EMOREWEE. Thank you, Emory. Really appreciate you joining us today on the broadcast again.
Thank you for having me. It was fun.
You bet. So I want to come back to take a quick break here. We'll come back with some thoughts. We got some actually breaking news falling out from Michael Cohen's testimony. So we'll drag you back there. But as you were, I know, chomping at the bit to have
a
point
here. I just had this one thought that I want to add in here, that I think that this public protest, this public pressure campaign that the Sunrise Movement is conducting is actually working, because Senator Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, mm-hmm. the Republican Senate Majority Leader, had originally said he wanted to have a vote on the Green New Deal immediately in the Senate. But after protests at his office, he has now pushed off that vote until August.
Yeah, I know. When I heard him say he wanted to do that, I was like, are you sure, Mitch?
Yeah,
are you sure you want to have a vote on that? So
exactly.
So we will find how split the caucus is. Well, I was going to say soon enough, but maybe not until August. All right, quick break, and we're back with some closing thoughts from a remarkable week. Right here on the broadcast, I'm Brad Friedman. Welcome back to the broadcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Some breaking news from NBC reporting that House Democrats are now preparing a case to request Donald Trump's tax returns. They are crafting a request to send to the IRS and say they will take, quote, all necessary steps to obtain the president's returns. This is something that they had said previously they planned to do, but they were going to wait till after the Mueller report. Now they say that the testimony from Michael Cohen has changed that calculation, and they are going to speed up this request. Following Cohen's claims that Donald Trump would inflate or deflate his actual worth, when he was, trying to get loans from banks or dealing with insurance companies, etc. So that is about to happen. And just to drag you back in to the Michael Cohen hearings for a moment here, just to sort of put a coda for now on that hearing, incredible hearing on Wednesday and this past remarkable week, there were some closing comments that I think are worth hearing if you didn't make it to the bitter end of that Cohen hearing on Wednesday. Cohen himself was allowed to make some closing remarks, and he included a thought that others have argued, sort of a chilling note, that if Trump loses in 2020, he says, there will never be a peaceful transition of power. Now, I don't know if I agree with that, but I know that some are very concerned about exactly that. I'm, frankly, more concerned about Donald Trump winning in 2020, to be frank, by hook or as likely by crook. But Michael Cohen knows Trump, after some 10 years of working with him personally, about as well as anyone. So I think his comments here, chilling or otherwise, are worth hearing.
My loyalty to Mr. Trump has cost me everything. My family's happiness, friendships, my law license, my company, my livelihood, my honor, my reputation, and soon my freedom. And I will not sit back, say nothing, and allow him to do the same to the country. Indeed, given my experience working for Mr. Trump, I fear that if he loses the election in 2020, that there will never be a peaceful transition of power. And this is why I agreed to appear before you today. And in closing, I'd like to say directly to the president, we honor our veterans even in the rain. You tell the truth even when it doesn't aggrandize you. You respect the law and our incredible law enforcement agents. You don't villainize them. You don't disparage generals, Gold Star families, prisoners of war, and other heroes who had the courage to fight for this country. You don't attack the media and those who question what you don't like or what you don't want them to say. And you take responsibility for your own dirty deeds. You don't use your power of your bully pulpit to destroy the credibility of those who speak out against you. You don't separate families from one another or demonize those looking to America for a better life. You don't vilify people at the expense of our allies. And finally, you don't shut down the government before Christmas and New Year's just to simply appease your base. This behavior is churlish. It denigrates the office of the president, and it's simply un-American. And it's not you. So to those who support the president and his rhetoric, as I once did, I pray the country doesn't make the same mistakes that I have made or pay the heavy price that my family and I are paying. And I thank you very much for this additional time, Chairman.
Michael Cohen at the end of his open testimony before the U.S. House Oversight Committee on Wednesday in what I think will... Well, we'll see, but may potentially turn out to be just landmark testimony and a turning point in this entire bizarre saga.
I would hope so, but like you said, we'll see.
Also, a warning there about what happens if Donald Trump loses in 2020, but we will see. And lastly, one righteous rant, as you called it, Desi Doyen, from House Oversight and Reform Committee Chair Democratic Congressman Elijah Cummings of Maryland at the very bitter end of the Michael Cohen hearing, in response perhaps in no small part to that comment about a peaceful transition in 2020 and the need, as he put it, to get back to normal in this country. Yes, please, Mr. Chairman.
It sounds to me like you want to make sure that our democracy stays intact. The one meeting I had with President Trump, I said to him, the greatest gift that you and I, Mr. President, can give to our children is making sure that we give them a democracy that is intact. A not democracy better than the one that we came upon. And I'm hoping that the things you said today will help us begin to get back there. When we're dancing with the angels, the question will be asked, in 2019, What do we do to make sure we kept our democracy intact? Did we stand on the sidelines and say nothing? Did we play games? And I'm tired of these statements saying, people come in here and say, oh, this is the first hearing. It is not the first hearing. The first hearing was with regard to prescription drugs. Remember, a little girl, a lady sat there, Miss Wortham, her daughter died because she could not get $333 a month in insulin. That was our first hearing. Second hearing, H.R. 1, voting rights, corruption in government. Come on now. We can do more than one thing. And we have got to get back to normal. With that, this meeting is adjourned.
Chairman Elijah Cummings and his righteous rant at the end of Michael Cohen's testimony in the House Oversight Committee.
When we are dancing with the angels, they will ask, what did you do in 2019?
I know what we did, and it was exhausting. But we will, yes. As he said, we'll be back to normal in time for our next thrilling broadcast. I hope you will join us when that happens. Until then, my thanks today to our producer, Desi Doyen, to my guest, Emily Atkin of The New Republican, to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. It is always our honor and pleasure. Thank you. If you missed any portion of today's show or any other, you can download all of them for free at bradblog.com. You can drop me email. I am bradcast@bradblog.com. I read everything that comes in, and I try to reply to as many as I can as well. You can also find, follow, and share what we do on the Twitters and the Facebooks at TheBradBlog. And finally, as ever, my great thanks to those of you who stopped by bradblog.com/donate, especially those who sign up for monthly subscriptions of any amount you like. The broadcast is free. It's free to all. We try to get it out as widely, as broadly as possible over your public airwaves. But we do ask, if you don't mind, to help us out a little bit. What did you do in 2019? bradblog.com/donate, because we're all in this mess together. All right, that's it. Until we meet again, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.